This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. There has not been much to laugh about since the pandemic struck. However, now that COVID restrictions are loosening up a bit, the medium of stand-up comedy is getting back on its feet. So after a year of pandemic that included major social and political events, what's it like to get back up on stage? We've invited two stand-up comics from Detroit to talk to us about what's going on with them and how they're doing. It happens that they're both part of the LGBTQ community. And so we were also curious to talk to them about how identity interplays with their work and with the rooms where they work. Joe Asim hosts the monthly comedy night in Hamtramck called Neapolitan Ice Cream. Welcome, Joe.
Hi.
And also with us is a 5-year veteran of the Michigan comedy scene, Diana Graham. Diana, hi there.
Hello.
Let's start out with a question for both of you. I'm just curious about how you moved into stand-up. I mean, this is a medium with no safety net. Diana, do you want to talk about how you got started?
All right. I think I was just obsessed with comedy throughout my teenage years. And it was just something where I was like, oh, I have to do this. And I eventually started to find different venues that would host me.
Tell us about some of your favorites.
My very first open mic was a mixed medium open mic out in Milford at an art collective. And I'm forever grateful for that venue.
Oh my gosh. First show in Milford. That sounds like the name of a release. Totally. But actually, I was curious about like what comedians you were so obsessed with growing up, like who was really making you pay attention.
My first ones were, I think, Dan Cummins and John Mulaney.
Yes. Joe, what was your entree into this?
So I grew up in North Florida in a college town. And for me, actually, the first show I did was a Holiday Inn hotel lobby off of I-75. It was an open mic that a guy I worked at the Mellow Mushroom Pizza place was performing on. He was like, hey, you say some funny stuff in the kitchen, you should come on out and say some funny stuff there too.
Oh my gosh, that almost sounds like losing a bet. Like, was it a tough room?
Yeah, it was a weird room. And then the more I think about it, the more I think about how weird that room truly was. It was like a mix of people that were there for the show. So some college kids, a lot of like young folks who think that, you know, I told some funny jokes, I'm going to get out there and try it. And then passers through that were staying, whether they were passing through as truckers right off staying, you know, just the night for their work, or if they're passing through on business, or there were local folks, because it was kind of on the outskirts of town, so you would have some folks that maybe lived out in more rural areas that might make their way in because they had really great drink specials at the bar, at the hotel bar. So really, real blend of a lot of North Florida's finest in terms of audiences.
So needless to say, you killed, right?
I won't even get it. It's so bad. But yeah, I didn't do fantastic, but I got some laughs. I got enough laughs to not be totally discouraging. I think I had one funny thing that I knew I could say that would get a laugh, and I'm too embarrassed to even think about it. But yeah, no, it started off a little shaky. But it's that first laugh that you get, right? That first thing that you know, you go out and you surprise them with that thing you were going to surprise them with that kind of hooks you. Or I don't know, Diana, if like you had an experience that like hooked you the way that did. I think for me, it was like you get that first laugh and you just, oh, there's something about it.
Diana, do you remember the first time you really got somebody to sort of explode?
I think my most memorable that's comparable to that is I did a joke in my first set that made fun of people for not calling people that go into the arts like a real job. And what a great place to do that at, make that joke at an art collective. And what I love so much is not only did people think it was funny, but they all like related to it. And I was like, oh, I'm being relatable.
So many liberal arts majors in that room, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And honestly, that sounds like kind of a perfect first gig.
It was pretty good looking back on it.
The thing that kills me is that even people who are very, very, very good at stand-up, they still have a lot of highs and a lot of lows. Are there days, both of you, when you're like, wow, that was an amazing set, I can't wait to get out there again, or alternately, why in God's name am I doing this? Joe?
I mean, yeah. Just to keep it on the high note, I did, earlier this month was my first, I think a lot of folks' first shows back after pandemic time or after their quarantine situation, whatever it's been. I think that's a really important one for a lot of comics coming back and for a lot of audience members too. My first one back was in Grand Rapids earlier this month, kicking off some Pride fundraising for them at Tip Top Tavern.
Yeah.
And it was with Diana. Diana was there as well. And that was one of the ones where I, like, wasn't sure what was going to happen, wasn't sure how I was going to feel. I'd fallen asleep in the car, like, on the way, you know, like 20 minutes outside of town. So I was really in a weird headspace. And
oh, no.
It was such a great show. It was an amazing lineup. Shout out to Kane Strav for putting together an amazing lineup for that. Obviously, I'm a little biased, but the crowd too, the crowd there is just like, it was a queer crowd. And like if you can imagine queer jokes being as regular as straight jokes were, I know that's kind of a clumsy way of putting it, but if like, just like having an audience that you just don't have to worry about something coming across as much, or like Diana said before, being relatable, that was kind of my most recent, like, oh, I got to get back out there and do that.
Yeah. Joe, I'm curious, what was the mood of the crowd like? Were people just like ravenous to laugh?
A little bit. I think a lot of how people chose to use their quarantine time, whether it's finding new media, we had a lot of binge watching of all sorts of things and a lot of great exposure for comics who may not have gotten found by people outside of perhaps their locale or their kind of local sphere of influence, where, you know, if you had any media online, I mean, Diana has a boatload more than I do. Your views shot up, you know, sitting there at work, watching the views climb for some of Diana's videos. Even I'm like, wow, this is like a time for everybody to find new stuff. And a lot of those folks are like giving comedy a chance in a way that maybe we didn't have before the pandemic, in the sense that like they're looking for something to like, not just a new thing, but something that like maybe they found and enjoyed, or they found a comic that they enjoyed over, you know, over pandemic time, which I think is true for pretty much everybody. Even if you weren't into comedy before, I bet that, you know, you found a comic out there. If you're listening, you know, I challenge you to find a comic that you haven't heard before that you like, because I bet they're out there.
Yeah, that's true. 31 flavors. Diana, do you have a lot of up and down times?
Definitely. I think right now I have a lot of Pride material in my current set that I'm doing, simply because it's Pride Month and I'm doing a lot of Pride shows. And that can go either way with different crowds. But sometimes it's almost a prideful thing to walk an entire audience.
I mean, I think you're really a grown up in the industry when you've reached that point, right?
For sure.
That's your coming of age. Hey, did either of you try any Zoom comedy during the pandemic?
I did one fundraiser for abuse victims with Joe, which was more fun than it sounds like. I did one Zoom show, but I just couldn't bring myself to do it, really. I felt so uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, I feel like the bits that worked were definitely a different kind of comedy. I saw people just sort of trying something other than what they would say in a live room. Maybe something more like episodic storytelling or just funny musical stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Joe, what about you? Did you do any Zoom experimentation?
I did. It's a funny thing coming to Zoom from the stand-up world, because you get on stage and it's just, you know, the battleground is kind of there, for lack of a better term. You have a mic, you have an audience in front of you in some sort of format, and those are kind of like your conditions for engagement, right? You have the people in front of you and you're sat up there and you get to go. On Zoom, especially in the past time, you have audience members as more, you know, kind of stepping up to be a more active role, in the sense that there's a bunch of different kind of logistical negotiations that have happened with Zoom, and I'm going to get a little technical about this, but
sure.
You have the laughter that you either can or can't hear, right? As a performer, we feed off of that. You start feeling that laughter wave and you're surfing.
Right.
You're off. And when you get a good one, you just let it roll. You don't even need to worry about the next 30 seconds of what's going to happen, because everybody's laughing. Maybe you pick something out to say. On Zoom, you have... Everybody has an identity, depending on the show. The ones that I did Nicole Melnick's Quarantine's Domity every Tuesday. And that was a really great situation, where normally you would have a bunch of comics, is the most common one I was familiar with doing. And I did a few different ones, primarily populated by comics, which isn't necessarily different from the current open mic situation. You'll have mainly comics at a
right
open mic. But sometimes you won't, but sometimes you'll have audience members at a physical open mic, where on Zoom it's primarily comics, and then the big X factor is, do they laugh?
Right.
Not so dirty secret, a lot of comics are not laughers, which it would behoove you, if you're a new comic or if you're out there listening to this thinking about trying stand-up comedy, learn how to laugh. Oh my goodness. A, will you have a better time? but B, you might even get gigs out of it.
I never thought of that before, but come to think of it, yeah, when you watch comedians watching other comedians, they're just mostly sitting there with their arms crossed and sort of like analyzing what's going on.
Yeah. Now, there is one big, large asterisk and exception to this, and that is our very own Noah Chapp. If you ever watch anybody watch Noah Chapp, it will be as amazing the second or third time as it is the first time, and I'll just leave it at that. but there's always an exception to the rule. And I know Diana's muted because she's laughing right now and being respectful, but that's the only exception to it. I think a lot of comics just don't, you know, they approach it because they're approaching it like work. We're approaching it like, you know, I'm getting ready to get my own mind right. I'm trying to bring the best me. They're maybe not as focused on being audience members the way on Zoom. That's kind of what you're doing, is paying attention, either active, you know, you're kind of upfront asked to be more of an engaged audience member on a Zoom mic. And you get different tools too. Like, you know, you find folks able to do little audio filter things, or like or one of my favorite bits, we're on Zoom so they can't see it, but I'm going to turn my camera on so you can see kind of how this bit goes.
Well, I unfortunately cannot see it, so Diana's going to narrate
goodness.
For us. Can you? No, really, this is good for the listeners. Diana, can you walk us through what's happening with Joe?
So the theater of Zoom is great because you have all these different rules of engagement. What's the password? Are you muted? What are all these other things going on? A lot of people will have bandwidth issues where, like, sometimes their screen will just freeze and...
Joe is frozen.
He's just still not frozen. Moving. Oh,
yes.
Boy.
And so that's a thing that, like,
you can really do on Zoom.
Point,
at this point, somebody leans into the screen and says, "You're frozen."
Exactly. So you're like, wait, are you muted? Are you? Or you can do the whole, I mean, it's an extended bit of something I've seen a number of comics. I think the last comic I saw do this bit was Reggie Watts. It's a fantastic, you know, you kind of just talking and then you kind of mouth the words as if the microphone isn't on. Somebody goes, oh, is the microphone on? Just a wonderful bit of playing off of tech difficulties, bandwidth. You know, another bit that you could only do over Zoom that I saw done with two folks, you can have a smoking room and a non-smoking room at the same time. And that's actually an accessibility tip that you can't really guarantee in a physical space.
It's so true. I appreciate the Reggie Watts hat tip. He's one of my favorites, too. Yeah, I think everybody's glad to get back to clubs, honestly. If you're just tuning in, we are Laughing It Up with two of Michigan's queer stand-up comics, Joe Ossim and Diana Graham. I was thinking about what you said about working a Pride fundraiser, Joe, and I don't think I've ever seen a queer stand-up who doesn't somehow at least mention, or if only casually mention, their identity. But obviously there are so many different kinds of rooms to play. I mean, if you're in there and you're reading a room and you get the gist that it's less than friendly or even just kind of uncertain, are there, shall we say, adjustments made in the material or in your demeanor?
Yeah. I mean, for me, that's like part of the rules of engagement in life. And I think for a lot of queers, we walk out the door, we're in a world that asks us to make adjustments or asks us to accommodate us and sometimes forces us to. So in a very real sense, queer comics are some of the most prepared people for a hostile environment. Anybody who's not, you know, who's not a straight white man kind of has to, you know, navigate that kind of dynamic. And for me on stage, adjustment wise, part of it is that they came to see the show. If they didn't think they were going to see this, boy, do we have a show in store for you. To me, that's like the best audience is the one that doesn't, that you're going to be unexpected for, because you have the element of surprise. They don't know what's going to happen. If I show up, you know, with bad facial hair and a long dress talking about how I just came from work, they're going to want to know. I've already got them. They already want to know what I do for work. They're going to want to know what Joe came from where, looking like what, doing what for money. Is it legal? Like, there's a whole set of, you know, you're in control of the mystery. I think that's part of the, for me at least, that's part of my dynamic I bring as the, you know, kind of first line of like, oh, this is going to be weird. Guess who's in charge of how weird it is?
Yeah. Guess what, person in the audience? It's not you. Diana, you have this amazing bit that you sometimes do about being non-binary and bisexual and dating a straight guy. I was kind of wondering if that serves as a bridge to people who, again, maybe aren't certain what's going on or might be resistant.
Yeah, I think just the way that I talk about certain things kind of makes it like, you know, if you can't understand me or you don't understand my identity, that's okay. We can still laugh at this like mutually funny thing together. I think I do get more questions afterwards because everybody is then, you know, wanting to know the intricacies of a non-binary identity and how that plays out. And, you know, I don't owe that to anyone, but sometimes I'll take the time for them. So it is overall productive for us all.
Yeah. How often do you get a chance, Diana, to be in a room that's all queer?
I mean, when I'm hanging out with my friends.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's not often. Like Joe said, that show we did out in Grand Rapids, that was a super awesome space to be in. So it's definitely something we're capable of creating for ourselves, but it's not something that happens without a purpose.
I mean, I don't have to tell you guys, this has just been such a year. And I do wonder a lot if you find yourself adapting your writing style to the truly bizarro times that the last 18 months have offered up. We've talked to just regular fiction and nonfiction writers who say that they're having trouble writing right now, and they're even having trouble reading right now. Has your creative process, Joe, or Diana, I guess I'll ask you first, has your creative process changed at all?
Oh, for sure. I used to write mostly just on stage. I had to explain this to my roommates recently, but like the reason I hadn't wrote new jokes in so long is because so many of my punchlines are written in the moment on stage. It comes to me while I'm working on a premise, working it out on stage. So to not have that outlet anymore, it really hindered how much I was writing.
That's pretty hardcore, Diana.
It's the greatest form of procrastination.
When I said working without a net, I didn't think you were really working without a net. That's amazing. Joe, how about you? I mean, is the process of working up material, has that become different for you as there have been different things to react to and really harsh things to react to?
Yeah, I think one of the things when we first started kind of, you know, this kind of journey inward is maybe like a kind way of putting it. Growing up in Florida is a weird place. So, like, disaster preparation is kind of baked into your mentality growing up. In some ways, winter is just a really long hurricane in that sense. And in some senses, for me, I think people, myself especially, kind of like, yeah, I guess disaster preparedness or kind of like mental readiness in terms of like how we're reprioritizing things. In terms of comedy writing, like, I think I'm part of a large number of people who just like didn't know if they were going to come back or they stopped writing for a certain amount of time. And I've been working as an essential worker this whole time, basically 9 to 5 during the week, dealing with at an animal hospital. So I work with kind of like a, you know, alongside human medical stuff, the very real imposition of like stuff that matters and is like immediately life altering alongside like, hey, I could tell that as a joke is a really, not like polar opposites necessarily, but those are really like different color schemes. Those don't quite go all the way together, but
sure.
At the same time, you know, I think part of comedy and superpowers, people think of comedy as a superpower sometimes. I'm going to put that out there because they both have the same origin story, which is trauma survival. Every single superhero's origin story is trauma survival. The vast majority of comics have some sort of trauma survival in their past, whether they talk about it or not is up to them. But I would challenge any comic who's worth, you know, their salt up there to proclaim that they don't, because I just don't think it's true. And I think that part of that coming out of that is an appreciation for survivorship specifically. And in comedy, like, you know, once you get out the other side, I think folks who have been writing writing every Tuesday and having new stuff to do every Tuesday has really changed the way I, honestly, just the way I approach the stage. Because like Diana, I used to just go do it, you know, do a lot of the stuff kind of coming up to the stage or have a weird thing happened to me and just kind of talk about it. But now there's like a little bit more of a like italicized, like I'm going to go up there and do this thing. And like, I didn't get all the way here just to half-ass it or just to like, you know, come up with half of something that I got all the way here for. If I'm going to be at something now, there's a little bit more of a purpose. Honestly, it feels more,
intentional.
Yeah. I mean, my role specifically, I talked to a lot of folks on the phone daily, and the stories and the things that come across the way, like, if anybody has a pet out there that's listening, you know, you feel the resonance of not being able to get an appointment for anything, whether it's regular, routine, or otherwise. But that we had gotten to a point where people, like, I had a woman tell me, "Don't cat lives matter?" on the phone.
Oh my God.
And at that point in time, I was not sure I was going to go back to do comedy on stage. But the audacity, just the sheer juxtaposition of somebody calling me at work and trying to use that as a bargaining chip, made me like, you know, I can't call this person at their work and ask them if their refrigerator is running, but I can get back on stage and tell the whole world how silly things have gotten.
Cat lives matter. As we speak, I'm having this made into a bumper sticker.
You know, as long as it's Creative Commons, go for it. I say spread the word, get those cats spayed. Their lives matter, but it's the unborn. I don't know. Like, yeah, you don't... wild enough stuff happens that you gotta go back
working.
To it, right? Like, this is just... It's
he's,
made up
he's
for
He's working
me.
Right now, yeah. Joe Awesome is our favorite kind of Florida man, the kind who lives in Michigan. He will be emceeing the next Neapolitan Ice Cream Showcase, which is July 11th, a Sunday at Trixie's in Hamtramck. Diana Graham, where can the people find you?
Oh, boy. On the internet.
The internet. The safest place to do stand-up, I'm sure. Except never. Diana, Joe, it's been really a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking a couple of minutes to be with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.